Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with tensions between two nuclear powers, India and Pakistan, following an escalation in response to a suicide bombing that killed over 40 Indian troops, in which Indian warplanes bombed Pakistani territory. Then Pakistan shot down one or two Indian aircraft, capturing a pilot. An expert on India and Pakistan who speaks and reads Hindi, Urdu, and Punjabi, Christine Fair, a professor in the Security Studies program at Georgetown University and author of Fighting to the End, The Pakistan Army's Way of War, joins us to discuss how the real crisis was not in New Delhi or Islamabad, but in Washington, where nobody was minding the store to de-escalate the crisis, which fortunately has been dialed down, with Pakistan's prime minister announcing the captured pilot's release. We will look into Trump's ego-driven foreign policy, the priority of which is to fulfill campaign promises, no matter how ridiculous, like the wall Mexico was supposed to pay for. In this case, it is his campaign promise to get out of Afghanistan, which he is expecting the Pakistanis to help make happen by brokering a peace deal, in quotes, with the Taliban on Pakistan's terms before the 2020 elections, which will sell out the Afghans, reward the Taliban, and make a mockery of the U.S. investment and sacrifice in Afghanistan. Then we'll speak with Dr. Guy Zib, a professor at American University School of International Studies and director of the Israel Security Project, an online repository with statements by Israeli security experts who favor a two-state solution to the Israel-Palestinian conflict. The author of Why Hawks Become Doves, Shimon Peres and Foreign Policy Change in Israel, he joins us to discuss the indictments of Prime Minister Netanyahu on serious bribery and breach of trust charges, which could impact the April elections, since Netanyahu is facing a serious challenge from the left with the former IDF Chief of Staff Benny Gantz in coalition with the popular centrist Yair Lapid. Then finally, we will assess the diplomatic train wreck in Hanoi following the collapse of Trump's second summit with Kim Jong-un, which abruptly ended in spite of the love affair Trump proclaimed he was having with the ruthless dictator. Sun Yun Lee, a professor of international affairs at the Fletcher School of Diplomacy at Tufts University, joins us to discuss his article at The Hill, Trump Checks Kim Jong-un's Hanoi Peace Ploy, and what steps are likely to follow this reality check to Trump's magical thinking that he could charm Kim with the art of the deal. And before we begin today's program, I want to thank listeners like you who are helping us build a new home online at backgroundbriefing.org. We encourage you to bookmark our new website and join the community of listeners we are building nationwide with your support at backgroundbriefing.org/donate to keep us independent and free from corporate sponsors so that we can continue to provide breaking news analysis from the most knowledgeable guests we can find as we build a reality-based community in post-truth America. And joining us now is Christine Fair, who is a professor in the Security Studies program within Georgetown University's Edmund A. Walsh School of Foreign Service. She previously served as a political officer with the United Nations Assistance Mission in Afghanistan and Kabul, and she is the author of Fighting to the End, The Pakistan Army's Way of War, and in their own words, Understanding Lashkar-e-Taiba. And she speaks and reads Hindi, Urdu, and Punjabi. Welcome to Background Briefing, Christine Fair.
Thank you for having me again.
And it looks as if the crisis between the two nuclear armed powers, Pakistan and India, is receding. But my sense is that the real crisis has been in Washington.
The crisis has been in Washington. Trump appears to be absent, although there seems to be some social media reporting that he is trying to take credit for the off-ramping of the pilot. Whether or not there's any truth to that remains to be seen. I personally am somewhat skeptical because Trump has had a very different kind of expectation from the Pakistanis, namely that the Pakistanis are going to help bring forward some kind of a deal with the Taliban that will allow Trump to fulfill another one of his dangerous, misguided, and ill-informed campaign promises to be out of Afghanistan by the 2020 election. So if you look at some of the comments that the Pakistan ambassador to the United States said yesterday, it's very clear that he was expecting the Trump administration to support Pakistan unstintingly and sit on India to just take the terrorist attack that Pakistan launched against it.
But is there any evidence that he, I mean, when you have a crisis like this, particularly one between two nuclear powers, any normal American president would be right on top of it, trying to mediate and avoid what would be a massive catastrophe. I mean, there's been a report out for some time that if India and Pakistan went to war with nuclear weapons, it would kill billions of people and cause global damage that would last for decades.
Yeah, I mean, but he's been completely absent as far as anyone can discern. I mean, part of the problem is that we don't have an assistant secretary for South Asia. We don't have any actual, we only have acting deputy assistant secretaries. We don't have a secretary of defense, and much of the infrastructure within DOD is also vacant. I mean, everyone was asking, where is the U.S. president? 20 years ago, when the two, in fact, that was the event at which you and I met 20 years ago, was over the so-called Cargill crisis. Compare how President Clinton was very engaged at all periods during the crisis, including providing personally an off-ramp to the absent dereliction of duty. In fact, you had countries such as France that had condemned the Pakistani behavior, and there was very little coming from the United States. I mean, people were asking, literally, where is the U.S. president?
So the person that is actually under the president in terms of foreign policy, of course, is the Secretary of State, and I'm not sure that he's much better than Trump. He's so unctuous and such a toady. And one of the things that I find most troubling about him, apart from the fact that he spends all his time blaming Obama for all the problems in the world, which is exactly what Trump does, but he's also a religious fundamentalist, as is Vice President Pence, and by the way, as is the Prime Minister of India, Modi. And this guy, Pompeo, believes in the rapture, and so does our Vice President. So I worry about our leadership, not in terms of having an erratic and possibly insane person as a president with access to the nuclear button, but those below him in the chain of command are also compromised by their bizarre religious fundamentalist beliefs.
Well, you know, I'm not going to speak to that, but what I will say is that, you know, Pompeo seems to have been the only person of whom there is any record of being involved in this crisis. He spoke with the Secretary of India's MEA, which is essentially their State Department, and he actually delivered a message that was very irritating to the Pakistanis. He reiterated India's right to defend itself, and he also did condemn Pakistan for using terrorism. This was not the message that Pakistan had hoped to get, even though it is the message that has been consistently delivered since 2016. Prior to 2016, most U.S. officials commenting upon these crisis slides would usually say something like, you know, we encourage both sides to resolve all outstanding disputes through negotiation. And that language actually rewarded the Pakistanis. So the U.S. has refrained from that kind of language during the end of the Obama administration. And in fact, the kind of statements that Pompeo made was not terribly dissimilar from the kinds of statements that Hillary Clinton, for example, would have made under similar circumstances. So I think the real issue, from my point of view, is not so much whatever they believe or don't believe with regard to their sky tyrant, is that we had two states, one of whom is a victim of terrorism and the other is a perpetrator of terrorism, and the United States was really absent as this crisis unfolded. And instead, what you saw was countries such as China stepping into the leadership vacuum that the United States had left. And that is very worrisome that the United States, and of course, ostensibly, this is unfolding during the North Korean hijinks. So if President Trump had come out of his negotiations with Kim Jong-un with a deal, maybe we could have forgiven him that he was completely absent during this particular crisis. But as we know, that's not what unfolded. And of course, it is typically expected of a U.S. president that they should be able to handle multiple competing priorities of incredible intensity simultaneously.
And again, I'm speaking with Christine Fair, who is a professor in the Security Studies program within Georgetown University's Edmund A. Walsh School of Foreign Service. She previously served as a political officer with the United Nations Assistance Mission to Afghanistan, and she's the author of Fighting to the End, The Pakistan Army's Way of War, and In Their Own Words, Understanding Lashkar-e-Taiba, and she speaks and reads Hindi, Urdu, and Punjabi. So yeah, I know you've met with these Lashkar-e-Taiba terrorists, and you wrote a book about their mindset. Have you ever dealt with the Jaish-e Mohammed, the people that are, who supposedly had this terrorist camp or were behind the suicide bombing that killed 40 paramilitary officers in the Indian Army, and then their so-called terrorist camp in disputed territory was bombed, although there's some doubts about whether anything was bombed except a forest.
Well, actually, where the camp was located wasn't disputed at all. Uh-huh. The camp was actually located in Khyber Pakhtunkhwa, which is an undisputed Pakistani territory. Uh-huh. To get there, the Indian planes came across the line of control, flew through Kashmir, which is disputed by Pakistan, and dropped the ordnance in Khyber Pakhtunkhwa, which is not disputed territory. And it's likely that the planes had to have flown through Khyber Pakhtunkhwa to make that ordnance drop. Irrespective of what they bombed or they didn't bomb, it's going to be impossible for the Indians to show what they did because, you know, there's no drone footage. I mean, we would be able to do a damage assessment if you used a standoff weapon from a drone, or perhaps, perhaps if there had been cameras on the weapons themselves, even though we wouldn't see what had happened after detonation, we would still at least see what the ordnance was flying at prior to detonation. So it's going to be very difficult for the Indians to prove convincingly what they did or did not do in Balakot. And the Pakistanis have cordoned off the area. They're not letting anyone go near the place. So the chances of the ordinary citizens like you and me knowing what did or didn't happen is pretty low.
But assuming that that Jaish-e-Mohammed were behind the bombing, the suicide bombing, and
they were, of course, they took credit for it. No question that they did
All right. So, have you ever interacted with these people, and what is their? Aren't they a kind of a proxy for Pakistan's military intelligence?
So, first, no, I've never met with them. Remember, you know, they have a lot of relationships to the Taliban. The Taliban helped give them birth. And, of course, I've met, you know, failed Taliban suicide bombers. But I've never interacted with a flag member of Jaish-e-Mohammed. Jaish-e-Mohammed, like Lashkar-e-Taiba, like the Taliban, are very much proxies of the ISI. There is virtually no doubt that the ISI was behind this attack. The suicide bomber, he was driving a vehicle-borne IED. They have not used, Jaish-e-Mohammed, by the way, is the one that brought suicide attacks to Kashmir. But they haven't used them in 19 years. And there's no way this fellow learned how to drive a vehicle-borne, a truck bomb, without some degree of training. We know that he disappeared almost a year ago from his village, and he's likely been in Pakistan for much of that time. So, you know, we definitely know that Jaish did it. We know that Jaish is an ISI asset, and there's really no disputing that.
So what's the ISI's agenda? I mean, I thought they owned the prime minister.
Their agenda, so first of all, just in general, Pakistan has a problem, right? It wants to change maps in South Asia, but it has an army that can start wars but can't win them, and it has nuclear weapons it can't use without resulting in the destruction of the Pakistani state as we know it, right? If Pakistan, after a nuclear exchange with India, it simply doesn't survive. India survives, it's hobbled, many people are killed, but Pakistan will no longer be a geopolitical entity as it exists today, right? So what does Pakistan do? It has no other means at its disposal other than to use terrorists under its nuclear umbrella. And Pakistan's gotten away with this for years. You know, it conducts a terrorist attack. Its nuclear weapons has generally deterred the Indians from taking provocative action. The nuclear weapons have also drawn in international actors to tell India in particular to don't de-escalate, et cetera. And then maybe they would also tell Pakistan, shame on you, shame on you. But in fact, Pakistan never had any consequences of its behavior. And so it's continued to do this. The closest it came to being punished was in 2016 when the Pakistanis again used, it was Lashkar-e Taiba, and the prime minister responded by sending in special operators across the LOC to attack several bases associated with the terrorist group. So it's going to do this. It has to do it because it's an international insurgent. How does it show to India that it hasn't acquiesced to the status quo? It doesn't have to defeat India. It just has to show that India hasn't defeated it. So there will be these terrorist attacks, as there are, with some frequency. But what explains the who, what, why, where, and how of this attack? There's one important strategic consideration. One of those considerations is that for several years now, Al-Qaeda, Indian subcontinent, as well as the Islamic State, had been hijacking the Kashmir issue. They'd been hectoring Indians and Indian Muslims generally, and Kashmiri Muslims in particular. You know, they're putting up with this Hindu nationalist, you know, they're degrading you, there's cow lynchings, and you're just going to the slaughter. So Rawalpindi has wanted to re-exert control over this for quite some time. And the fact that they were able to recruit a young local Kashmiri boy to do this is one of the ways in which they were able to re-exert control over the Kashmir issue. Usually when they've sent suicide bombers, they've been Pakistani. To my knowledge, this is the first Kashmiri suicide bomber. And then the second issue, which is very important, is that the Pakistan deep state wants Prime Minister Modi to be reelected. And that might sound counterintuitive, but what Pakistan has to deal with domestically is some ongoing rabble-rousing by a very important group called the Pashtun Tehfuz Movement. And these are Pashtuns who figured out what Pakistan's game is, that Pakistan is supporting terrorism, that Pashtuns are paying the price for it. In their marches, they have a very pithy slogan that says, Ye jo deshat gardi hain, iske piche vardi hain, which says that the terrorism that you're seeing is really caused by the army. And for them to be able to do what they need to do to suppress this movement, which has really got the Pakistan military shaking in its boots, it needs to have a very big, scary enemy on the east, and that's India. So I think that's the other important consideration here, is that the Pakistanis, all else equal, really do prefer a Modi government sitting there than anyone else, in the sense that a Modi government can justify the fear-mongering in which the Pakistan army engages.
And the fact that the Pashtuns are woken to the ISI's duplicity, the Pashtuns, of course, are largely where the Taliban comes from. So is this going on with the Taliban now negotiating with the United States? Do they recognize how much they've been used and abused by the Pakistan military?
So the Pashtun Tehfuz movement, I mean, they also have no use for the Taliban either, right? Mm-hmm. Either the Pakistani Taliban or the Afghan Taliban. I mean, this is a group of people, they're just tired of being preyed upon. And the Pakistanis need to be fearful because the Pashtuns are about 35% of the population. They're overrepresented in the Pakistan army, and they're the ruling condominium. So unlike the Baloch, where the Pakistanis can just murder them with impunity, they can't do that with these Pashtuns. But going to your point about Afghan negotiations with the Taliban, unfortunately, this has nothing to do with the Afghan government. This is being completely driven by President Trump and his domestic politics of wanting to be out of Afghanistan. They are really quite being, there's just no positive word for this. They have thrown President Ghani under the bus. They're not involving the Afghan government at all. They're basically trying to figure out how can the Taliban and the Pakistanis give Donald Trump a nice little bow tie so that when he contests the 2020 election, he can say, oh, look, I did it. And, you know, he's been very clear about not caring about the consequences of his actions. You know, he has said on multiple times about a variety of policies that it doesn't really concern me if things go south, because I'll either be reelected, in which case it doesn't matter, or I won't be reelected, and it's someone else's problem. So So Pakistanis, I think this is one of the reasons why the Pakistanis thought that they could get away with this, is that the Trump administration needs them to hand him some kind of a graceful exit from Afghanistan.
Well, you've given us a lot to think about, and I appreciate it, Christine Fair. Thank you for joining us.
Hey, thank you. Have a great day.
Well, after that, I'm not sure I'm going to have a great day, but thank you all the same.
Yeah. I mean, as long as he's in the White House, there's not going to be a great day.
And again, I've been speaking with Christine Fair, as a professor in the Security Studies program within Georgetown University's Edmund A. Walsh School of Foreign Service. She previously served as a political officer with the United Nations Assistance Mission to Afghanistan in Kabul and is the author of Fighting to the End, The Pakistan Army's Way of War, and In Their Own Words, Understanding Lashkar-e-Taiba. And she speaks and reads Hindi, Urdu and Punjabi. We're going to take a brief station break and back discussing the indictments of Prime Minister Netanyahu on serious bribery and breach of trust charges. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Dr. Guy Ziv, a professor at American University School of International Service and director of the Israel National Security Project, an online repository of statements by Israeli security experts who favor a two-state solution to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. He's the author of Why Hawks Become Doves, Shimon Peres, and Foreign Policy Change in Israel. Welcome to Background Briefing, Dr. Guy Ziv.
Thank you.
And today, not a surprise, but still an earth-shattering development in Israel. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has been indicted on bribery and breach of trust charges, and he's entitled to a hearing on these indictments, but not until after the elections, which is coming up soon. So he's blaming it all on the political left. How do you see it, Dr. Ziv?
Well, he is in a struggle for his political survival. So he's going to blame the left. He's going to blame the courts. He's going to blame the media. He's already used some of the, you know, terminology we've become familiar here in this country from the from President Trump, you know, witch hunt. And he's definitely upping up his ante in that regard.
Well, he's saying he's blaming it all on the left, saying the left knows that with such feats they can beat us in the ballot. That's why for 3 years they have been carrying out political persecution against us in order to topple the right-wing government. So persecution, I guess that's pretty much what Trump talks about.
That's right.
Behaves. So I see that connection clearly. But these charges aren't frivolous, are they? I mean, it sounds like there may be some substance to it. You know, the bribery case involves alleged gifts from overseas billionaires totaling about $280,000, cigars, champagne, jewelry, and more. I don't know whether that's Adelson, but possibly is. And then a breach of trust.
It's another Hollywood media mogul, not Adelson. Some of the other charges are, it's a Hollywood producer who wanted favors in exchange for these gifts. But the other charges are even more serious because they involve the media. And basically, you know, bribery and breach of trust with the media. And he was the communications minister and took advantage and exploited that position for favorable coverage. And so that's a more serious charge.
Specifically,
investigations have been ongoing for years. I mean, these are not new. What is new is the Attorney General's decision to go ahead and essentially conclude, as the police have already, that there is enough evidence to indict him.
Well, these breach of trust charges stem from essentially getting favorable coverage by making deals with a big daily newspaper, you do it or not, and basically, obviously, getting Sheldon Adelson to agree that not to compete so much with his free mouthpiece of his newspaper, which is considered a mouthpiece of Netanyahu's. And then the other case is another telecommunications company where they made favorable regulatory deals of at least $1 billion shekels. That's 280
That's right.
million. And also favorable coverage from one of their news outlets, Walla News.
That's right. That's because the big telecommunications firm in Israel.
So
they own Walla, which is the website that you're referring to.
Right. And was it Arnon Milchan that you're referring to?
Arnon Milchan was the Hollywood producer. That's
right.
That's correct.
Yeah.
That's the first case that you mentioned.
Right. So, you know, there's been reports about the personalities of the. I mean, yesterday we saw essentially Michael Cohen talk both about the criminality of Donald Trump, but also the personality, and not a pretty picture. And my understanding is it's not a pretty picture in terms of the Netanyahu family. The wife seems to have a little bit of a Marie Antoinette attitude, and the son seems to be quite arrogant. I understand he has a large dog that he won't pick up the doggy doo-doo.
When the dog was alive. The dog died a year or so ago. But that's true.
Right. So give us your description of this family, this ruling family. They've been in power for a long time, and what the attitudes are. Or is this the same as Trump? You know, you got the people in the Fox bubble that just love him and can't find fault with him, and the people on MSNBC who can't wait to have him in chains. So is that the same deal in Israel?
I think you hit the nail on the head with these parallels, because those of us who do observe Israeli politics and American politics are seeing so many of these parallels and others. The kind of demagoguery and attacks on the gatekeepers of democracy, like the courts and the media and anyone who dares to utter criticism. And what's interesting in the Netanyahu case is that so many of these people who he's going after are not leftists, and they don't even have a dog in this fight politically. In fact, the attorney general, whose decision it was Netanyahu's contesting, was a Netanyahu appointee. He was Netanyahu's cabinet secretary. So this is somebody who Netanyahu wanted to promote, and the same goes for some of the judges in the courts that have been appointees of Netanyahu and his justice minister, Ayala Shaked, who's a far-right minister in his government from a rival conservative party. So we're talking about instances here of criminality that have nothing to do with politics, yet he is, as we said, using kind of this witch hunt claim to try to deflect the criticism.
And again, I'm speaking with Dr. Guy Ziv, who's a professor at American University School of International Service and director of the Israel National Security Project, an online repository of statements by Israeli security experts who favor a two-state solution to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. And he's the author of Why Hawks Become Doves, Shimon Peres and Foreign Policy Change in Israel. Another parallel, if you will, or something to do with the Trump administration, is, of course, we've seen the amateurism of Donald Trump blow up in his face in terms of diplomacy in Hanoi with the North Koreans. But we've also seen what seems to me to be amateurism on the part of the son-in-law, Jared Kushner, who has this big comprehensive peace deal that he's supposed to be working on. He went on TV in the Emirates and outlined for the first time, he actually made a TV appearance talking about this peace plan that he has. It's been never been revealed before, and it basically tried to dispel the idea that the plan was biased towards Israel, and said that they were going to deal with the core issues, borders, questions, etc., and they want to see a unified Palestinian entity instead of the present split between Hamas and the PLA. That's apparently backfired in Israel. It's caused a split on the Israeli right.
Well, it's not entirely clear if the Israeli government was caught off guard or if all of this has been coordinated with Netanyahu. Keep in mind that Netanyahu is very close with the Trump administration and vice versa. They've been very supportive of each other.
Right, and they're family friends of the Kushners.
And they're friends of the Kushners. So I don't think anybody's holding their breath about the peace process being resumed anytime soon. Keep in mind that the Palestinians aren't even on speaking terms with the Trump administration. And so we're not even halfway there. But anytime this is raised, it's going to create some questions in Israel as to what it is that the Trump administration is really trying to do here. But the general consensus is that President Trump would like to help his friend Netanyahu get reelected, and certainly doesn't want to do anything that would jeopardize Netanyahu's reelection. And therefore, when Netanyahu is here next month for the AIPAC conference, he'll likely meet with President Trump, and this would be quite the photo op for him in Israel, where President Trump is generally seen as a friend, and this could probably help Netanyahu and certainly not harm him.
And this would be ahead of the April 9th election?
Correct. All of this is ahead of the April 9th election. The visit to Washington and the just-announced visit of President Bolsonaro of Brazil to Israel. And that, too, is, you know, we're dealing with a controversial right-wing populist leader who is kind of seen as quasi-authoritarian or maybe more than quasi-authoritarian, yet he, too, gets along well with Netanyahu, and that visit also is aimed at shoring up his support.
And Netanyahu has already had a visit with Orban in Hungary and the new right-wing leaders in Poland along similar lines, right?
Yeah, I think what he's trying to show, I mean, I don't know if the average Israeli really focuses on each one of these leaders or really knows all that much about them, but I think what he's trying to show is that he is the adult in the room. He has relations in many different places around the world, that Israel is not isolated, and all that is due to his statesmanship and ability to navigate, you know, foreign policy and national security.
But ironically, there's always been a disconnect between right-wing Israeli governments and their Jewish American supporters of Israel, who tend to vote on the left, I think to the tune of about two-thirds or three-quarters voting, for example, for Obama and for Clinton. And how much is the fact that Netanyahu has made a deal with this extreme right-wing party founded or disciples of the late Rabbi Kahan?
I would say it's a very big deal. And this gap that you're referring to between American Jews and Israel has become rather significant in recent years, in large part because Netanyahu has interfered in American politics. You might recall that in 2012, he invited Obama's rival, Mitt Romney, to Israel during the height of that election, banking on him winning the election. Of course, he lost. And then several years later, in 2015, he came here to speak to a joint session of Congress to try to undermine the Iran deal. And so these kinds of incidents did not endear him to the American Jewish community, which is largely liberal, progressive, supports Democrats, not Republicans. And this latest merger deal that he orchestrated with a far right, it has not been sitting well at all with the American Jewish community. And you might have heard that even AIPAC, while extending an invitation to him, publicly criticized that merger. And that's something that they rarely do, is because they don't want to interfere in Israeli politics. But they came out with a pretty significant statement for AIPAC that was highly critical of that decision to bring in that far-right party into the Knesset.
Well, Netanyahu, though, it's not just being partisan against Obama, as you mentioned. It goes back even further. On the eve of, I think it was certainly one of the White House meetings with Netanyahu and Arafat. Before that meeting, when Bill Clinton was president, Netanyahu, on the eve of the White House meeting, did a rally with, I think it was Jerry Falwell, the televangelist,
right,
who was saying that Bill Clinton had murdered his best friend, Vince Foster.
Yes, that was a meeting, an infamous meeting that they had, I think, at the Mayflower Hotel, if I recall correctly.
Right.
Prior to Netanyahu's meeting with President Clinton. And that did not endear himself to President Clinton either. You're right.
And I talked to
him. He does have a history of doing that, yes.
Right, and I talked to one of the participants in that meeting who said that after the meeting, Clinton was just absolutely furious, and he turned to his aides and said, who is the effing superpower around here?
That's right, yes.
So what do you think at the end of the day is going to happen here? I mean, a lot of people are concerned. There have been concerns expressed about Donald Trump, you know, doing some wag the dog war if his numbers start plummeting any further. And if obviously the Korean summit was a disaster, and it was coincided with incredibly damaging testimony against him by Michael Cohen. This seems like a blow also, I don't know, on the same level, but to Netanyahu. I know he and MBS and the hawks in our administration, the National Security Advisor Bolton, who was apparently put in there at the behest of Sheldon Adelson, mm-hmm. There's rumors about wanting to do something with Iran. I can't imagine any serious military action in the Gulf being anything but a catastrophe, which may end up, you know, raising the price of oil through the ceiling, which would, of course, would help Putin and really hurt the Europeans. So what do you think about those rumors of wag the dog scenario?
Yeah, I think that, I mean, look, anything is possible, but I don't, Netanyahu himself is a rather risk-averse leader when it comes to both peacemaking, but also when it comes to initiating a war. And so I'm hesitant to make any kind of prediction in that regard. I think the most critical thing to look out for in the weeks ahead is what is the direction that his campaign is going to go in. We know that he's going to continue to defend himself and bash the left and bash the courts and the media. But is the opposition, his primary opposition, which we haven't talked about in this conversation, is a pretty key factor as well in this election, because you have for the first time three, not one, but three former IDF chiefs of staff who have joined forces with Yair Lapid, who's a pretty popular centrist politician, to try to unseat Netanyahu. And if they succeed in getting enough right-wing voters to support them, then we might see kind of a seismic shift in the balance between right and left in the next election. Keep in mind, though, that you still are going to have Netanyahu's base, and most of that will likely be intact. So one of the things we're going to look out for in the polls in the days and weeks ahead is whether or not that base is going to tear it, you know, is whether or not that a high percentage of that base will leave him. But as of now, his supporters have been pretty loyal to him, and Likud voters have been pretty loyal to the party, and nobody on the right has really called on him to step down. And I'm including not just his own party, but the other right-wing parties and the religious parties have said that, you know, they're okay with him staying.
So just in closing, the main challenge, of course, is the former chief of staff, Benny Gantz.
That's right.
Is he going to benefit, though, from this move to the far right with the Kahanas people, which is having a backlash here in the United States amongst American Jewry? Is it possible that the center-right could defect, or does Lapid have the center-right?
It's possible, but it's not clear yet. It's not clear yet, because so far, as of today, the balance between the right and the left blocks hasn't shifted all that much. Most of the support that Benny Gantz and Lapid have been receiving has come from the center-left. And so you see kind of laborers in shambles, and the merits parties, you know, might become even smaller than it is, and is on the cusp of disappearing altogether. So most of the support is coming from the center-left, not from the right. So the big question is whether or not enough right-wing voters are going to be disgusted by, you know, the far right coming into the Knesset because of Netanyahu's move, because of the corruption investigations, and we don't know. We don't know how it's going to go. It's also possible that people are going to lie to the pollsters. So we really won't know for sure until Election Day. But right now, I think that Netanyahu is definitely fearful of his career. This is probably the worst moment in his political life.
Well, Dr. Geisev, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thanks for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with Dr. Guy Ziv, who's a professor at American University School of International Service and director of the Israel National Security Project, an online repository of statements by Israeli security experts who favor a two-state solution to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. And he's the author of Why Hawks Become Doves, Shimon Peres and Foreign Policy Change in Israel. We're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back assessing the diplomatic train wreck in Hanoi following the collapse of Trump's second summit with Kim Jong-un. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Sung Yoon Lee, a professor of international affairs at the Fletcher School of Diplomacy at Tufts University, a National Asia Research Fellow, and an associate in research at the Korea Institute at Harvard University. And he has an article at The Hill, Trump Checks Kim Jong-un's Hanoi Peace Ploy. Welcome to Background Briefing, Sung Yoon Lee.
Thank you.
So the general consensus is, first of all, going in, most people were skeptical that this was just going to be a photo op like the first summit in Singapore, and that Trump was more motivated by getting a Nobel Prize than he was by making any kind of decent, lasting and worthwhile deal. But now the critics are basically saying, well, thank God it collapsed and he didn't sign a bad deal. Where do you come down?
Well, it indeed did seem that President Trump in Hanoi would give away the farm and a lot more. The writing was sort of on the wall going into the second tete-a-tete with the North Korean tyrant. All indications were that the swagger of the initial meeting last year in Singapore, when Trump the next day tweeted, "There is no longer a nuclear threat from Korea," that kind of, you know, boasting, veni, vidi, vici, I came, I saw, I conquered, that was gone. And now Trump was saying he's willing to take his time. He's not going to push the North Korean. There's fantastic chemistry between the two men. So things were not very promising. But I don't know, of course, what exactly transpired. But I do give President Trump credit for walking away and not settling for a faulty deal. I think the North Korean leader probably overreached and tried to push Trump too far.
Well, the one thing now that's always been apparent, given that the North Korean regime is a combination of a cult and a mafia family, the fact that he seems totally blind to who this man is, Kim Jong-un, and the depravity of his rule, which the United Nations has copiously documented. And a lot of people are upset with Trump's sort of offhand remark about Otto Warmbier accepting Kim's version of saying, oh, you know, I knew nothing about it, and therefore I'm not responsible. Very much like the outrage over the Helsinki press conference with Putin. So that seems to be a systemic problem that we have with the president. Do you think he really is smitten with despots and the power that they wield?
I think he improvises irresponsibly quite often. You know, that comment that he believes he's willing to give Kim Jong-un the benefit of the doubt, Kim Jong-un, who is the world's leading candidate for indictment for crimes against humanity in the International Criminal Court, a man who is a third-generational despot, whose family regime has really elevated the art of strategic deception, more simply known as lying in your face, really to another level, to say that he is willing to trust such a man is disappointing. you know, there was a lawsuit by the Wombeer family and in the federal court in D.C. in mid-December, there was a trial, and I participated as an expert witness. And the federal judge, the Chief Justice, just 5 days later issued a judgment, you know, which awarded the plaintiffs punitive damages and found North Korea guilty of hostage taking, torture, and extrajudicial killing. So to say that in a system like North Korea, where the man on top is a demigod, that he did not know of this international issue, which dragged on for over a year and a half, a young American man who was taken hostage in 2016 when North Korea was preparing for its nuclear test just 3 days after detaining Otto Warmbier on January 6th, 4 days, pardon me, and also conducting a long-range missile test a month later in February, another nuclear test later in the year, that Kim Jong-un had no idea of the conditions of the American hostage is not credible.
Well, of course, the fact that they haven't had any tests, nuclear tests or missile tests, since the Singapore summit is something that a lot of, certainly Trump is reminding us of it. And by all reasonable standards, wouldn't that be at least progress?
Not really, because, you know, on the eve of his departure for Hanoi, President Trump said, as long as there's no testing, we're happy. By that measure, you know, the happiness index must have soared through the White House roof during the three separate, distinct, three-year lulls, periods, in Pyongyang's nuclear tests. So the first nuclear test was in 2006, and then North Korea refrained from conducting another test until its second in 2009, 3 years. And from 2009 to 2013, there was no test. From 2013 to 2016, there was no test. So by that metric, if President Trump deserves the Nobel Peace Prize for slightly more than 1 year of non-flagrant violation of UN Security Council resolutions, which, as we know, prohibit such activities, then perhaps President Obama and President George W. Bush each deserve three Nobel Peace Prizes each.
And again, I'm speaking with Sung-Yoon Lee, a professor of international affairs at the Fletcher School of Diplomacy at Tufts University, a National Asia Research Fellow and an associate in research at the Korea Institute at Harvard University. And he has an article at The Hill, Trump Checks Kim Jong-un's Hanoi Peace Ploy. So there's an interesting article in Thursday's New York Times, interview with a very high-ranking North Korean diplomat who managed to defect with his family, and he's living under protection in the South. We know how hit teams are sent in to kill these kind of people. And he describes Kim Jong-un as being intelligent, bright, wily, but a merciless guy. Now, that's not any news, I guess, to any of us, particularly you, but what's your sense of what is Trump talking about? Love letters, friendship, and all this stuff. Is that just him trying to butter the guy up? Because it sounds like, you know, there was a sort of almost magical thinking on President Trump's part that he could just be, you know, be nice to this guy, flatter him, do a sales job. He's, after all, Trump is a salesman. And do you think that's what happened here, that he just simply didn't realize who he's dealing with?
Well, for some people, fantasy is reality. And I guess President Trump made the mistake of actually meeting in person with the object of his desire, Kim Jong-un, as George Bernard Shaw tells us, quote, "The perfect love affair is conducted exclusively by post." So love letters are fine, but you meet and then you have this false illusion that there's some chemistry or understanding achieved and that it's reciprocal. And then you are more prone to giving more concessions. So Kim has really trapped Trump, in my view, in a typical North Korean drawn-out negotiation process, a labyrinthian process, by making piecemeal concessions, which are really no concessions, like decommissioning an infrastructure, an underground test site that North Korea no longer needs after 6 underground tests. So by making these gestures, North Korea is able to wrest away more money in the form of non-sanctions, lax sanctions enforcement, subsidization by China and South Korea, and perhaps most importantly, buy time to perfect the bomb. That's been the North Korean pattern, the carrot and stick strategy since the early 90s. Act crazy, act weird, then moderate your behavior, engage the outside world. They all come running. They take the bait because they all opt for de-escalation, understandably so. And then North Korea reaps billions, literally billions, while they continue to build the bomb.
Well, one of the problems they had with the negotiation apparently was that the North Koreans would not give the U.S. an inventory of what they have. I mean, you can't have a dialogue or a negotiation over denuclearization unless, you know, we know what the size of the U.S. arsenal is, and it's pretty extraordinary compared to the North Koreans. But still, you need to have a baseline, surely, of what they have and what they would accept as deterrence. And that never happened. And one of the concerns, my understanding, is that North Korea, at some point or other, if the sanctions continue, and obviously these talks broke down over the fact that Kim wanted all the sanctions removed right away, there's a fear that Kim Jong-un, in order to get money, because he depends on money for his mafia family to control the place and do the patronage system that keeps the elite in line, could start selling nuclear technology around the world, nuclear weapons. So that's got to be a huge concern. What's your sense of whether that is a realistic option, that, you know, he could start making and selling nukes, and that way he could take care of his own self, his own privileges, and then maybe trickle some of that down to the people?
Well, in an academic, metaphysical, philosophical discussion, the answer would be we don't know. But in the secular world, we go by precedents and evidence available. What has North Korea done so far? It has sold missiles, nuclear technology to Iran and Pakistan. It has built a nuclear reactor, a facsimile of the main plutonium reactor in Yongbyon. It built one in Syria, which Israel bombed in September 2007. North Korea has sold chemical weapons and clothing, gears, and tools to Syria as well. It has sold weapons to any buyer out there. So, I mean, the risk of nuclear proliferation. Oh, it has also sold uranium hexafluoride to Colonel Gaddafi. So that risk is real, and even the gargantuan task of containing, trying to prevent North Korea from proliferating, there's just no guarantee that it will ever be successful. So to settle for North Korea as it is, which is a de facto nuclear state, and to say we can deal with North Korea, we've dealt with China and Russia and India and Pakistan and Israel, and the UK and France have been responsible nuclear powers, so North Korea, we can expect to abide by the norms of international society. Well, maybe, but maybe not.
Well, one of the things I learned from this trip, this aborted summit in Hanoi, is that there's apparently a small cemetery outside of Hanoi where North Korean pilots, the bodies have been repatriated, but the tombstones are still there, that North Korean pilots fought against the Americans in dogfights during the Vietnam War. And also, apparently, during Mao Zedong's time, the grandfather of Kim took his train, the armored train, the very one that Kim went all that way. What took him 63 hours or something extraordinary,
yeah.
And we'll have to go back as well, that Kim went to meet Mao and asked Mao's permission to invade South Korea.
Yes, this was as Saigon was falling, as South Vietnam was falling in April 1975. We've heard a lot in recent weeks and months about the so-called Vietnam model. Pompeo preached it during his visit to Hanoi last July. in a message to North Korea. He had just been rebuffed by Kim and mistreated by his counterpart in Pyongyang, and then he flew directly from Pyongyang to Vietnam. And Mr. Pompeo said, look at this economic development. Vietnam was a former adversary, but we have a wonderful relationship today with Vietnam. You too can achieve this. This miracle can be yours too. Very well-intentioned message, but I imagine Kim Jong-un and his minions have been having daily bursts of uncontrollable, painful laughter every day since, because the Vietnam model has a specific definition, as you suggested. The Vietnam model means become an unbearable political burden to the United States, coax the U.S. with, of course, sticks, wielding sticks as well, become a credible threat, and then coax the U.S. into signing a peace agreement, as the U.S. did in January 1973, the Paris Peace Accords, and then compel the U.S. to withdraw from the South, as North Vietnam did in 1973, resume war of liberation, and move right in and complete national unification. So excited by what was unfolding in his ally, North Vietnam, what North Vietnam was doing to the South in 1975, Kim Il-sung, the original great leader, you know, he visited Beijing and sought Chinese support for a military solution to Korean unification. However, Chairman Mao, no longer the youthful, vigorous revolutionary of yesteryears, he said, no, thank you.
So just in closing then, is there going to be a third summit?
I believe so at some point, because both men want it. You know, when a prize fight hyped up as the summit was, ends in a draw, an unsatisfactory draw or a controversial decision, usually there's a sequel and everyone makes more money and everyone's happy. You know, there's enough star power here in the two men for another summit, which will garner the world's attention. And I think by then, Kim will be even better positioned to wrest away substantive concessions while making just salami-like piecemeal concessions to the U.S. And the key concession, in my mind, that Kim wants, that the regime has sought really very hard for 50 years now, is a peace agreement. And a lot of people think that a peace agreement would de-escalate tension, you know, diffuse tension and make things all right. Well, maybe, but then maybe not. There are, you know, I mentioned the 1973 peace agreement that triggered war immediately thereafter. There's the 1939 Ribbentrop-Molotov Pact, non-aggression pact between Hitler and Stalin that brought on war the next year. So, you know, peace has such a hypnotic, alluring ring to it. It's so attractive. Everyone wants peace, obviously. But a peace agreement would render the UN command null and void. It would immediately lead to the dismantle of the UN command in South Korea that was established in the wake of the Korean War. And also, a peace agreement would call into question the raison d'etre of U.S. forces in South Korea and probably U.S. forces in Japan as well in this brave new world, you know, completely different world of formal fake peace. And also, you know, it'll be very difficult to resume sanctions enforcement against the Kim regime in this era of peace. So bit by bit, through graduated escalation as well as carrots, sugar-coated placation, North Korea will be able to compel the South, the richer South, to pay up. It will be very well positioned, even better than it is now, to extort the South. And by and by, North Korea will be able to control South Korea, if not outright invade, take over. That sounds far-fetched, I know, because North Korea is so backward and so laughable. But to them, this is a matter of life and death. It's a non-negotiable proposition.
Well, Sung-Yoon Lee, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you very much.
And again, I've been speaking with Sung-Yoon Lee, who's a professor of international affairs at the Fletcher School of Diplomacy at Tufts University, a National Asia Research Fellow, and an associate in research at the Korea Institute at Harvard University. And he has an article at The Hill, Trump Checks Kim Jong-un's Hanoi Peace Ploy. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available at backgroundbriefing.org, where we have just made it easier for you to sign up for email updates as well as subscribe wherever you get your podcast. If you like this program, we encourage you to rate and review us on iTunes, Google Play, and SoundCloud. And please do share today's program with friends, family, and colleagues on Twitter and Facebook. We've also made it easier for you to help us sustain our mission, spread the word, and keep us corporate and commercial free by adding a donation button. So if you are in a position to give support, please take a moment and visit backgroundbriefing.org/donate, where your tax-deductible contributions will help us continue to make America think again. Bye for now.